Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Christogenia, or Christogenos, rather. I keep on mixing my title up with Bill's. And we're gonna take a break from the two seed line theme, although we probably will integrate that theme into tonight's show at some point. Our scheduled program is to have an interview with Jonathan Gray, and he's the author of a book, The Corpse Came Back. And in that book, he talks about various ancient mythologies, which have been incorporated into modern mythologies. Okay, and I'm reminded, as we wait for him to call in, I'm reminded of a video called Zeitgeist. And Zeitgeist, although it's mainly about economics, it begins for some reason with an attempt to demythologize the life of Christ, or actually, I should put it the other way, it's an attempt to mythologize the life of Christ. And by claiming that all of these stories, namely the virgin birth and the wounded Savior, et cetera, are really old stories, and it's just that Christianity has picked up these old stories and transferred them to Jesus Christ. Okay, so using this logic, they say, well, all of these, every one of these stories that apply to Jesus Christ actually happened to somebody else first, and then Christians simply made up this whole business about Jesus Christ being the Messiah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And in my opinion, the Zeitgeist people are absolutely wrong. They have no idea what they're talking about. In fact, I have on my website, anglo-saxonisrael.com, in the archive section, a page, or an article rather, called The Prophetic Maseroth, which shows that Adam, Seth, and Enoch composed what's known today as the Zodiac. And it's that zodiac which is very, very ancient, and all other zodiacs are borrowed from that original zodiac. And that zodiac, in fact, prophesied the life of Christ and using imagery in the sky to do so. Okay? So we definitely understand that this mythology is Christian from the very beginning. And it was, in fact, borrowed by non-Christians, turned into mythology. The original Christian significance was lost. And then, lo and behold, Jesus Christ came to fulfill all of it. Okay. Bill, what's your perspective on that?
Well, what I'll say is that I have ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament in front of me.
Okay.
And I've read this entire book, and it's a very, very, I mean, it's well over 1,000 pages. I don't know. It's a bunch of pages, and,
right,
and it's small print. So
yeah, right. It's like the Bible.
It's not light reading.
Yes.
I'm sorry. It's about 700 and something pages.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Anyway, it's all of the, actually a man named Pritchard, who works at Princeton University, collected all of the ancient Assyrian and Babylonian and Egyptian manuscripts, the inscriptions and translations, the inscriptions that are closest to the Old Testament stories. And, you know, there is no doubt that there are many parallels between Hebrewism and the mythology of the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if there weren't parallels, then I would be worried about the Bible.
Right.
Because all of these people had the same origin in the white descendants of Noah,
mm-hmm.
and this is where Western civilization began.
Right.
So if they don't have basically the same or similar myths, then we have a problem.
Right.
However,
right,
in many ways, they do have the same and similar myths.
Mm-hmm.
And the Greek mythology is a full reflection of Babylonian and Assyrian mythology.
Right,
And that can be discussed at great length, and that's actually a huge study
mm-hmm,
in comparative religion, and you know that universities do that. I mean, they have it all screwed up and backwards because they believe the Jewish story.
Right.
But they make these studies all the time. However, any accounts, first Isaiah announced a virgin birth in 750 B.C.
Okay.
Okay? And there are no accounts that predate that of a virgin birth
okay.
in Assyrian, Babylonian, or Egyptian mythology.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay? Now, even the Sargon of Akkad
yeah.
story, where he was, there's similar stories about his birth and being very similar to the birth of Moses, the reed basket in the swamp or the river
right.
or floating down the river and being found by the whole thing is basically a copy of this of the Exodus story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this Sargon of Agade story that a lot of them point to try to defraud the Exodus, this is not found in Assyrian or Babylonian inscriptions until the Neo-Babylonian period
okay.
and the Neo-Assyrian period, which isn't until the
yeah.
7th or 8th century B.C.
Right, right. So it's very contemporary or past the time of our prophets, the Hebrew prophets.
It's well past the time of when Moses wrote the Exodus or the Pentateuch, and it's well past the time of the Hebrew prophets.
Right, right. Yeah, and when Suzanne Olson was on my show and we were talking about the archaeological evidence for the grave sites of Moses and Abraham and people like that, we got into a discussion of Hinduism and Buddhism. And it, you know, and from my perspective, Buddhism is only dated back to 700 BC and no earlier. Okay, and then she, go ahead.
I really don't know if you could date Buddhism that early.
Mm-hmm.
A gentleman named Dr. George Moore.
Okay,
he wrote a book in like 1860. I've read the book. It's been many years since I've read the book, and I can't any longer quote it verbatim.
Yeah.
However, the name of the book is The Lost Tribes of Israel and the Saxons of the West and the Saxons of the East. It's still available. In fact, it's available on the internet. And if anybody wants a copy of the PDF file, then I'll email it to them if they email me a request
mm-hmm. okay.
at williamfink@christogenia.org.
Right.
However, this book, he makes a clear connection between the Israelites of the dispersion and Buddhism.
Okay.
The Buddhist religion is basically the religion of the punishment of the Israelites in their humiliation.
Yes.
They founded this religion that was supposed to be about self-debasement and humiliation.
Yes.
And that was how Buddhism originated.
Yes. Okay. Without the hair shirt.
without the hair shirt. But the English wore hair shirts as tenants in the Middle Ages. So.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and then, well, what she went on to say about Hinduism was that she considered Hinduism also to be a very late religion, having basically taken bits and pieces from all, you know, religions and traditions and documents that they could find, assembled them all together in a hodgepodge of material, and call it Hinduism, okay? And that none of it actually predates the era that we're talking about. In fact, Hinduism, which claims to be thousands of years old, is in fact, no older than Buddhism.
Well, you know, in a way it is thousands of years old because they borrowed from this religion
that's right.
thousands of years old. They borrowed from that religion that's thousands of years old.
Yes, exactly.
But none of it's theirs.
Right, yeah, and so they just blended it all together, and I guess this is why they got, you know, this multiplicity of gods and goddesses that they worship and, you know, make idols to.
Well, but basically, I have never seen proof of the Vedas or the Hindu poetry. I've never seen actual proof of that. I know all the claims concerning its antiquity.
Yes.
I've never seen proof of its antiquity.
Right.
I've never seen anybody dig a papyri out of the ground that was 3,000 years old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, and if anything, those documents, so like the Vedas, are more than likely they were probably written by Aryans anyway, and I think everybody agrees that they were. And those original documents were more than likely, in my opinion, written by the descendants of Abraham. Okay, and so they didn't teach Buddhism. I mean, they didn't teach Hinduism. Hinduism was simply something that evolved later on, you know, gradually from this hodgepodge of borrowings that they did, you know. And in my opinion, Buddha was a Saxon, so that a descendant of Buzai, who was either the father or uncle of Ezekiel, I forget what the filial connection is there.
I don't remember the exact name, but Buddha's real name begins in the syllables Shaka.
Yeah, right. Shakyamuni.
And,
exactly.
And those syllables are identified with the Shaka or the Saxons.
Yes.
And all right, the Parthians king was called Arsaces,
mm-hmm.
and Ar means mountain or high point, and he's the highest of the Shaka.
Right.
That's where that word comes from.
Okay.
And that's just an example. That word Sagalassos, I mean, there's all Sakasene.
Yes.
There's all sorts of words that are equated with this, you know, connected to the Saxons that begin in those syllables.
Right, right. And so the word Shakyamuni, which is actually the title that the Buddha assumed, means sage of the Saxon clan. Okay. And I think Isabel Elder was the one who authored a book about that subject as well, showing that that Buddha was actually a Saxon. And, you know, and as you mentioned earlier, it was a religion that was actually based on Hebrewism and, of course, just picked and choosed various doctrines, assembled them together, and, you know, far away from the seat of Jerusalem, and, you know, became known as Buddhism.
Right, and none of them were actually recorded until very late in
right.
history either, in writing.
Yes, yes. So here we go, and the Jews do the same thing. They claim to have an oral tradition that's many thousands of years old, okay? And there's no evidence of any. They made it up, during the first millennium A.D. It's called
right.
the Talmud.
The Talmud was recorded in writing by rabbis and by Pharisees, whatever they were, in Babylon, and that's why it's called the Babylonian Talmud. And it wasn't. They didn't actually begin recording it and writing until the first or second centuries.
Yes, yes. Okay. Now, I'm not sure if Jonathan Gray is having any trouble. I sent him several emails about the time differential between Eastern time in New York, Central time in Chicago, and New Zealand time. And New Zealand time is about 17 hours before Chicago time, okay, which means that when he calls in, he'll be calling in from the future, okay?
All you really had to do was direct him to my internet radio page where wherever you are in the world, you see what time it is in New York.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
And I have that set up purposely like that.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's good to know. But I told him to check in first because the TalkShoe site gives a countdown to the start of the show.
Yes, that's true also.
Right, and so if you do that, you know, you could check it out earlier in the day, and you'll know exactly how many, minutes and hours are left before the show starts. So I don't know if he's having any trouble or, whether somehow he was not able to access that information. In any case, ladies and gentlemen, we're still waiting for Jonathan Gray to call in. In the meantime, I'm going to go ahead because part of tonight's discussion was going to be the Tower of Babel scenario, because in his book, The Corpse Came Back, he has a chapter on the dispersion of languages. And so, and I know, Bill, we have talked about this previously, but not as the main theme of our discussion. Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 through 9, talks about the Tower of Babel incident and the dispersion of the languages. So here, let me just quote these first few verses. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Bill, what do you make of that very first sentence, the whole earth? Because very often this expression, the whole earth and the face of the earth, is really an expression that means, the known world, not the entire planet.
The whole land.
Yes.
It's the whole land. The word eretz means land. It doesn't mean the whole planet. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
All of being language today. And I don't mean us personally. I mean, as a society, the academics have a huge problem because of the false distinctions drawn between the so-called Indo-European languages and the so-called Shemitic languages.
Mm-hmm.
And the Shemitic languages, they're actually Indo-European. They have all the features of Indo-European languages.
Right. Yeah.
And I'd argue that with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The verbs have tenses.
Well,
the nouns have cases. They're inflected. They have number.
Right.
All the features of our languages that the Oriental and the African and all the other the alien language of the world don't have. And Greek actually was a lot more in its earliest stages was a lot more like Hebrew was with a dual noun and features like that Hebrew has, which are peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that Greek had them.
Yes.
And a lot of Greek words on my website, there's an English from Hebrew section that proves beyond all doubt that the English language is basically Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
That I mean, hundreds and hundreds of English words.
Yeah. Well, Tyndale said that all he had to do to translate Hebrew to English was replace the Hebrew words with the English words. The syntax was identical.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, there's one paper on my website that I have a link to. It's a Russian archaeologist named S.A. Grigoriev,
mm-hmm.
and he, through the study of linguistics and in conjunction with linguists, has actually traced the Indo-European languages back to ancient, well, what we know today is Kurdistan,
yes.
But it was the ancient land of Paddan Aram and the people of Abraham.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's not a stretch to go back just a little bit further in time, and I mean, possibly he couldn't do it historically, but we're not very far from Babylonia and ancient Sumer.
Right, right, right. Okay, so this land of Shinar is pretty much a synonym for Sumeria, right?
Well, Shinar is Sumer, okay? The Mesopotamia, in early times, the lowest part of it was known as Sumer or Shinar at various times.
Okay.
And that's also the greater Babylonia or the land around Babylon.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And the northern, above that in Mesopotamia, between the rivers, is the land Akkad, where
mm-hmm.
there was a city Akkad. But in ancient times, the two lands, the further south of the peninsula was Sumer, and the further north was Akkad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they were called Sumer and Akkad.
Okay. Now, there's one guest, R.P. Wake. I don't know if that would be, I've never seen that handle before. If Jonathan Gray happens to be in the chat room, just send us a message, you know, and we'll explain to you how to call in if you're trying. Okay, so verse 3 here, again, we're in chapter 11 of Genesis. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach to heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And there's that expression again, the face of the earth, or in this case, the face of the whole earth. And this can't possibly mean the planet Earth. It's talking
right.
about
no,
the territory we live in.
The whole land.
Right, right.
And that's the way the word, I mean, the planet is very rarely referred to in the Bible.
Right.
And I think Job talks about the circle of the earth.
Right.
And that's a reference to the planet.
Right, and the earth hangeth upon nothing, meaning it's a globe in space, yes?
Right, and that's in Job.
Mm-hmm.
The earth hangeth upon nothing. And then it says, and shall not shake or something. And it, and
yeah, it will shake to and fro.
Will not waver.
It will shake to and fro when the judgment day comes, that's for
well,
sure.
Well, right, but that's a different prophecy.
That's right. Yeah.
Job is actually talking quite scientifically,
and
he means what he means by that is that the course of the earth will not waver.
Right, right. Now, I want to ask you here, what about this, how many different tribes or nations of the previous chapter in Genesis 10 could have possibly been involved in the construction of the Tower of Babel? You know, it sounds to me like we're really only talking about the Babylonians themselves, and possibly a few other nations in the vicinity. It can't be the case that all of these nations from Genesis 10 that were, you know, in this tight little area around Babel. What's your opinion of that?
Well, at first, I don't think it matters how many of them specifically, because we'll never know. We only have the account in Genesis chapter 10 and 11.
Mm-hmm.
We do have much evidence that the Kenites are already in this land,
mm-hmm.
When Noah and his descendants come into it after the flood.
Right.
And it's no doubt that knowing the patterns that they've set up in history, that the same pattern can't be extrapolated back to this time where they infiltrate Noah's descendants and try to set up a one-world religion.
Right, right.
And, that's the way I see it, even mm-hmm. though it can't be proven.
Right.
However, the ziggurats, the building of ziggurats, goes back maybe as far as 5,000 B.C.
Uh-huh.
It goes back very, very far in time.
Right.
And the descendants of Noah were absolutely caught up in this building of ziggurats, and they continued it. The Assyrians mm-hmm. and the Babylonians continued it for quite some time.
Yeah.
And I think that this is representative of something else. I think this is representative of a controlling religion and authority over all of the descendants of Noah.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't. In other words, it's globalism at that time.
Yes. Yes,
and
absolutely.
I believe this is representative of that.
Well, certainly Nimrod, and I forget where Nimrod is first spoken of in the scriptures.
Oh, he's in Genesis 10.
Okay, and one of the mistranslations, if I can turn back here real quickly, it says he was a mighty man before the Lord, and it gives the impression that he's a good man because it says before. But it's obvious that he's not a good man. here it is, chapter 10, verse 9. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Wherefore, it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before Yahweh. And, of course, the word before makes it the impression that he was Yahweh's servant in being this mighty hunter and creating these this empire. And, of course, that word before, I didn't have a chance to look it up, is a bad translation. And it should be, you know, he was a mighty hunter, you know, but, you know, as witnessed by Yahweh, you know, not necessarily being someone who is his servant necessarily. So I don't know, what's your take on that?
I'm trying to look up that word before.
Okay. Yeah, because...
It means... In the presence, that's all it means.
Okay, so in the presence. So why, yeah, and I've heard many people say that the word before means, you know, because that he's doing the will of Yahweh, and of course he wasn't.
It's just in the presence of
Yahweh. In the presence, so he was a mighty hunter in the presence of Yahweh, period.
Which is often seen as being arrogant.
Yes. Okay.
You know, and I think that could be equated with a man who wants to puff himself up and not humble himself before Yahweh.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah, so that word before actually means the opposite of what people think it does. It means that he puffed himself up before Yahweh.
Right. And the next famous hunter in Scripture is Esau.
Right. There you go. Yes. Yes. Okay. All right. Well, since we have yet to hear from Jonathan, I'm going to quote from his article. This is from chapter 11 of his book, The Corpse Came Back, The Languages and the Dispersion. In the first paragraph of this chapter, he says, imagine a town where suddenly many, many different languages were spoken. In the confusion, what would you do? Firstly, everyone would find those who speak their own language. Then decisions would be made about what to do next. It would be almost impossible to continue planting, harvesting, building with those to whom you cannot communicate, especially back then when there were no translators. And I would say, now, do you take this literally that, you know, these people working on this mountaintop or this construction site suddenly couldn't speak with each other? Or do you think that's an allegorical statement simply telling us that during these days, people migrated away from, you know, this area and began speaking dialects that ultimately couldn't stand understand each other anymore.
Well, if I don't know if you've heard my recent my recent writing on Genesis chapter 2 and 3, I believe it's all allegory.
Okay.
And I believe that this is allegory.
All right.
I don't think that this should be taken absolutely literally.
Okay.
And something caused the children of Israel in the area of Sumer or Shinar to disperse.
Yes.
And we don't exactly know what it was, and I'm sure it was divine providence that caused it.
Yes.
And this is an allegory explaining this to us.
Yes.
But you know, the Bible tells us what we need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see the distribution of our race in early history, as
right.
we've studied Genesis chapter 10 here.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to try to make up a story or
mm-hmm.
guess about what happened here, but language and the separation of the nations and the separation of the languages definitely had something to do with each
right.
other.
Well, in terms of migrating away from the area where Noah and his sons lived, you know, right after the flood, okay, and their population began to expand. They all couldn't live in the same area, so these various tribes had to start migrating to find living space and food, okay? And so, you know, for example, the Eskimos have 20 or more words for snow, you know, because they live in a cold environment. If you move south, as the Hamites did, you'd have maybe 20 or 30 words for sand, okay? And your language changes based on the environment you're in, and possibly because of the non-Adamic neighbors you have, and you learn words from them, et cetera, et cetera. And consequently, if the Japhethites moved north, which is, you know, where I feel they moved to, that the Shemites pretty much stayed in Mesopotamia, then you could see that their languages would change over time. You know, that's just natural.
You know, I don't have my Little in Scott lexicon within reach.
Okay.
But the Greeks have 17 different words for the verb to eat.
Okay.
And just
they
as
must
many.
Be fixated on food.
There's just as many for the verbs to come or to go.
Right.
And that's the, you know, I mean, so 20 words for snow isn't really amazing to me.
Right, right, yeah. And so, and then obviously, you know, as the people migrated further, you know, south, west, and north, and some of our ancestors actually migrated east toward India, okay, that, you know, they picked up new words depending on the environment they were in and the experiences they were having and the people they were relating to. You know, that's just natural. And I think one of the things in that we discussed Hebrew and English, you know, on a previous show, the language called Sanskrit was definitely one of the languages developed by the Aryans. Okay.
Now, here's a language that has many similarities to Hebrew, and it also has many similarities to Indo-European languages.
Yes.
And that's generally recognized by academics everywhere.
Yeah, but they discount the importance of Hebrew in there, you know, because they believed the lies of the Jews that they the only ones who spoke Hebrew.
Well, right. You know, there's a lot. If you look at Indian history, early Indian history, you'll see that there were a lot of even in Pakistan today, there's a popular city, or it might be in Afghanistan, named Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a name found of a city in the Bible.
Right.
And it simply just means a marked off area in Hebrew.
Okay.
And we get the word cable from it.
Right. Right.
And we find it in Afghanistan. There's a lot of place names in India, and Buddhists have recognized this for a long time, that are actually Hebrew place names.
Yes.
But that's because that's where the Saka settled.
Right, that's right.
Now, the Buddhists try to make up a story about Christ being there, and that's why all the Hebrew place names are there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. It's true that the dispersed Israelites, a generation or two later, were there.
Right.
And the Bible attests that they're there in Zephaniah chapter 3.
Okay.
And that's where it talks about
well,
his people beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, it's not talking about Ethiopia and Egypt.
Yeah, and doesn't
it's talking about Ethiopia in, of the East.
Right, and doesn't the Bible say that that's where Peter went? He went to Babylon.
Well, Peter went to Babylonia, right.
Mm-hmm.
And all the Catholics, those jokers, try to say, oh, that's a code word for Rome.
That's right.
But then when they get to the book of Revelation, they try to say, oh, no, that don't mean Rome. In other words, they try to use Peter's saying that he's in Babylon as saying that he's in Rome, but in the book of Revelation, where Babylon is spoken of disparagingly, they try to deny it, so they speak out of both sides of their mouths.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
The Sakka brought many Hebrew things to India with them, many place names, their language, their religion, which is Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
It spread into China, and the early Buddhist writings, they admit that Buddha had red hair. He was a white man. I've read an article in the Barnes Review, I wish I had it handy, that says that there are depictions of a white, red-headed Buddha in Buddhist temples in China.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep that rather suppressed because they really don't want to. The Chinese don't like to admit that Indo-Europeans had any impact at all on our culture.
Right.
We invented their whole culture.
Right. In the chat room, they're talking about Queen Elizabeth. And, one of the arguments I've had with the British Israelites is they try to argue that only the British are Israelites and that the Germans and, the Vikings, et cetera, are not Israelites. And of course, that's hogwash. The Vikings and Germans are Israelites. The Germans descend from the tribe of Judah, otherwise known as the Jutes. Okay.
Well, I wrote a whole series of essays that proved that the Germans came from the Scythians and the Cimmerians and are the dispersed Israelites.
Right.
And in part 6 of those essays, from Bede, their own venerable Bede.
Right, who was a Brit.
Bede says that the English, the Saxons in Britain are Germans.
That's right.
Bede calls them Germans.
That's right.
Bede calls the English Saxons Germans. Bede says that they sprung from the Germans.
That's right.
There's no
from
difference
Jutland,
between
actually.
An English Saxon and a German Saxon.
That's right, right. And I point out to these British Israelites who hate the Germans with a passion because, of course, they had 2 world wars with the Germans.
Well, they hate the Germans because they were taught to hate the Germans by the Jews.
By the Rothschilds, absolutely.
Who they also are convinced are Judah and nothing's further from the truth.
Right. But then, you look at Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria was a German lady of the House of Saxe-Coburg. She was brought up German.
Right.
And then
she
married
German.
Into the British throne.
Spoke German her whole life.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, when they try to say that the Germans are a different race, which is actually what they're trying to say, they're lying. All you have to do is look up their own history of the British throne. You can see it's a blatant lie. And then they try to say that the Germans are Japhethites or Assyrians in order to make, put together some kind of theory that the Germans are a different race from the British. And as you just quoted from Bede, it's nonsense.
Well, I could take pictures of my father's German family and all the childhood pictures, and I could take pictures of my mother's English family and all the childhood pictures, and I could throw them all into a pile.
Yeah.
And I would dare anybody to be able to pick out my father's ancestors from my mother's.
Right.
Or my father's childhood sister's childhood pictures
from
my mother's and her cousins and aunts and uncles when they were children.
Yes.
They can't be told apart. I'm sorry.
Right. I agree with you.
And they all had sandy brown or auburn hair, and they all had blue eyes, and they all had fair skin.
Yeah.
There were brown-eyed, brown-haired Englishmen, as well as there are brown-eyed, brown-haired Germans.
Sure.
And there are blue-eyed, blonde-haired Germans, and there are blue-eyed, blonde-haired Englishmen.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is.
Right.
And there's no there's no common sense separating these two peoples as being fully kindred, except for the Jews that lead Ephraim around by the nose.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, so Ephraim and Manasseh are commonly understood to be Britain and America, and there's a whole debate about which is which, and that's probably too difficult to separate. But Britain and America are Ephraim and Manasseh, and plus, you know, since we know that America is the regathering of all 12 tribes, that we have what? We have Germans. The Germans are the largest ethnic minority in America. 40 million Germans in this country. They're all Israelites, okay? And you have, you know, you have the Brits, the Irish, the Danes, the Zebulonites from Holland. The Danes should be obvious to everybody. That's the tribe of Dan, okay? The Finnish are Issachar, according to many. Gad,
I
believe,
I don't know
from
where
Spain.
That, some of that comes from. I'm going to be honest. I'm a little critical of some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have heard the relationships made.
Yes. Yes.
I think that
and this is I'm talking about British Israel literature, you know, Zebulon, Benjamin, Light to the Nations, which they consider to be Iceland, okay? It's from their own literature, you know.
Right, I understand that, but I can't understand how Benjamin could be how Iceland could be a Light to the Nations, because I don't ever see the gospel and the truth coming out of Iceland.
Right, yeah, it's kind of dim right now, isn't it? But of course it's kind of dim everywhere. So
right, but I mean the Irish have carried the gospel to the world more than probably anybody else in Europe.
Yes, yes, yeah. And obviously the Finns when they got up there there were a lot of Laplanders, and some of those Laplanders are probably, you know, Mongolian / Eskimo, hard to say. Mixing going on there.
You know, the Magyar tribes, the later Scythians that came into Europe, the Huns and the Magyars,
mm-hmm.
clearly mixed with some Oriental peoples. And I'm not saying they were all mixed, don't get me wrong, but there is clear archaeological evidence of, like, blonde-haired and Asiatic Mongol people in the same Scythian graves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's much evidence of that uncovered by Russian archaeologists, and it's all online, actually, in the Russian National Museum.
Yeah,
I've had much, I don't remember the exact link, but I've had much data and browsed the pages on the internet of that museum at great length.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so what we're seeing going on today is the routine character assassination of the white race, the white race being responsible for civilization as we know it, and then the Jews following in behind us and destroying everything we build, and then telling everybody we're evil. Okay. And so, you know, that's what Christian identity is all about, folks, that we're teaching that the Jews are the evil ones, and the white race is the promised people to the nations, okay? Let me continue on here because I guess we're going to do the show without Jonathan. Let me just quote from another paragraph in his article, and getting back to the language issue. Language is birthplace, and today nowhere else on earth can you find so many different tongues being spoken in such a small area. And he's talking about the Caucasus, Armenia and Scythia, north and south of the Caucasus and the Caucasus mountain range itself. Many ancient races
probably competes.
Pardon?
I think New Jersey probably
competes. Right. Yeah, you got a lot of dialects there. I can't understand most of them. Okay. New Jersey. Many ancient races and tribes still inhabit the Caucasus. Let's see. The mountains above Noah's Ark, which form the northern barrier of the Araxes Plain, and Araxes is referenced to a river, correct? The Araxes River?
Yes.
And the Armenian Plateau of eastern Anatolia. As many as 50 different languages and dialects are spoken in this vast and in parts inaccessible region. Strabo informs us, Book 11.5, that no less than 70 dialects were spoken in the country, which even then was called the Mountain of Languages. I never heard that expression before. What's your take on this?
I've never heard that expression either.
Yeah.
That Araxes River, by the way, is famous in Herodotus because that's the river that Darius fought to fight the Scythians.
Yes. Interesting, yeah. Yes, and R.P. Wake says, Noel Ignatieff said all social problems could be solved by the elimination of the white race. Yeah, and he's a Harvard professor. Now, why is that not hate speech?
Well, if he's a Harvard professor, there's a 70% chance he's a Jew.
That's right, because they're the only ones that have the money to go to college anymore. Okay, post-Babel writing. it would take some time and effort for the various language groups to work out a means of communication with each other, assuming, you know, he's taking this Bible, a Babel story, fairly literally here, and that whatever circumstances forced them to separate, wherever they settled, they pretty much developed new languages, okay? When true writing systems were organized, many times they contained bilingual inscriptions or the same message written side by side in two or more languages, which indicates the presence of numerous languages in the area. Now, of course, what is the Histun Rock, I think is the name of the rock. Where
the Histun Rock is the inscription of Darius and all the nations that he had ruled over during his reign.
Right. Now, those inscriptions are in three languages.
Yes.
Yes.
Actually, that was the Rosetta Stone of Akkadian cuneiform.
Okay, okay.
Sir Henry Rawlinson decoded that because we knew Farsi, we knew more modern Persian. He was able to decode the Persian, and the Persian part of the inscriptions, or Elamite,
yes,
actually helped him decode Akkadian cuneiform.
Okay. Yeah, now the interesting thing about that rock, about those inscriptions, is in two of the languages, the people being referred to are referred to as Qumri, and in another inscription, in other language, they're referred to as Sake. Okay.
Right. You know, on my website, in my German Origins Part 1, I cite an inscription from ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament,
mm-hmm.
and that is, they give the Elamite version.
Okay.
But Herodotus the historian had translated for us the Akkadian version.
Okay.
And it's the same exact wording in the inscription of in ancient Near Eastern texts.
Okay.
And in Herodotus, we have the same exact inscription talking about the Cimmerians and how they wore pointed hats. And
mm-hmm.
and the same, and in ancient Near Eastern texts, the Persian inscription calls the people,
yeah,
Saka.
Right. So therefore, it's clear that the Saka and the Cimmerians are the same people.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Now, the differentiation I make is I understand that the Cimmerians, that name accompanied those Israelites who migrated earlier from the Middle East to places like Spain and Britain and Normandy, et cetera, and Ireland, okay? And they brought the name Qumri with them. The Welsh today still refer to themselves as Qumri.
Well, yes, they brought the name Qumri with them, and the Greeks called them Cimmeroi,
okay,
which is what we know as Cimmerians.
Right.
And the Greeks called the first Scythians to cross into Europe,
mm-hmm,
as Cimmerians, first because they brought the name Qumri with them.
Right.
But second, because when the first Scythians crossed into Europe from Asia, Akkadian was the lingua franca.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and the Greek, uh-huh, diplomats spoke Akkadian.
Right, so they wouldn't have used the word Saka. They would have used the word Qumri.
Right,
mm-hmm,
exactly. And that's the point that my German Origins Part 1 paper tries to make.
Yes,
and
yes.
When the later Scythians came into Europe,
right,
Aramaean was the lingua franca.
Right. Now, wasn't that also the big difference there? Wasn't it true that the major migration went north of the Caucasus over land, okay, north of the Black Sea? And they're the ones that brought the so-called Saxon languages with them, which differ from Welsh and Scottish and Gaelic, etc., by an addition of Aramaic. Wouldn't that be the case?
Well, absolutely. You see, the first settlers, the earlier settlers of Western Europe, meaning the British Isles, the coast of France,
right,
the Iberian Peninsula, those people were Phoenicians.
Okay.
All right, and they spoke basically still their Hebrew language.
Right.
And there were also Trojans, and there were Phocian Greeks and a few others, but basically the most of the stock was Danan Israelite or Phoenician Israelite people.
Right, and for those people listening who haven't heard this before, the Phoenicians were definitely Israelites. They were paganized Israelites primarily, okay? They had ceased practicing the religion of Moses, had assumed a worship of various pagan gods and goddesses, and brought that worship with them wherever they went, okay? And this is one of the reasons why historians fail to equate them with the Hebrews, because they had adopted this pagan ideology, okay? Once you understand that the 10 northern tribes of Israel, and plus the smattering of the Judahites and Benjaminites that accompanied them, had actually begun practicing paganized religion, then it's easy to understand that these are Hebrews, not a so-called Aryan Phoenician. The Hebrews were Aryans, folks. There's no difference between Hebrews and Aryans.
The Cimmerians appear in the Greek world right at the time of Homer.
Right.
There's a Greek elegiac poet named Archilochus, and this can all be determined from his words and some of his contemporaries' words,
mm-hmm.
And from Homer himself. And these Cimmerians, they got one generation after the deportations of the first deportations, because the deportations of the Israelites by the Assyrians actually took at least 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think it's Isaiah even dates it to 65 years, and Ephraim will no longer be a nation, he says.
Yeah,
from the time that the Assyrians first appear in Israel.
Excuse me one second. Hold your thought. R.P. Wake says Eustace Mullins tries to link the Phoenicians with the Kenites, but
Eustace Mullins is wrong.
Yes.
I have a paper on my website which explains, in fact, I'll give you the name of the paper in 1 second, and
okay.
I'll paste the link into the forum.
Yeah, and I agree that Eustace Mullins actually became identity. But in his early days, he believed the lie that the Jews are the Hebrews.
Right. There's a paper on my website, Classical and Biblical Records Identifying the Phoenicians.
Mm-hmm.
I strongly urge R.P. Wake to read that paper, and he'll find it. The Phoenicians of the golden age of Phoenicia,
mm-hmm.
because the later Phoenicians are absolutely Canaanite.
Right.
But the Phoenicians of the golden age of Phoenicia are definitely the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So, and this is another thing historians get wrong. They simply do not make the differentiation between the Hebrew Phoenicians and the later Canaanite so-called Phoenicians. Okay, simply because they lived in the same territory, and these so-called scholars don't know the difference.
Well, there's no doubt that the children of Israel dominated that coastline.
Right.
And the
that's where they settled when they wiped
the Bible
the,
is as early as the Song of Deborah in the Book of Judges, chapter
right.
5.
They wiped the Canaanites off the face of the earth in that territory, okay, driving them south and north.
Eustace Mullins did an excellent job with the monetary system,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't do so good with biblical history.
Okay. Yes, yes. Yeah, so,
we all have our fortes, I guess.
Yeah, but
I would try to write about the monetary system.
Right, Eustace did come around later to understand that the Canaanites and the Jews are the same people, okay, and he eventually came to understand that the Hebrews are not Jews, so... That thinking was clarified in his mind eventually, But when he wrote the book, The Curse of Canaan, apparently he was not, fully aware of the different ethnicities that we're talking about, okay?
If the Hebrews were Jews, the Bible would be the primary textbook of the world's bankers today.
That's right. Well, actually it is, but they do the opposite of what the textbook tells them to do.
But I mean, the Bible would be a financial book. It
right.
would be a book about capitalist theory. It wouldn't have anything to do with God.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and they violate every law Moses ever wrote. So, there's no connection there. How can God's chosen people be the worst violators of his law? It doesn't make any sense, folks. It's a lie, okay? Let me continue here. Post-Babel writing. It would take some time and effort for the various language groups to work out a means of communication with each other. When true writing systems were organized, many times they contained bilingual inscriptions of the same message written side by side in two or more languages, which indicates the presence of numerous languages in the area. Quote, in Anatolia at least.
Excuse me, we're doing that today on all the instructions on every box sold in the store.
That's right. We got Babylon again, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Quote, in Anatolia, at least the ethnic and linguistic situation seems to have been exceedingly complex, although few, if any, inscriptions are available for this region before the rise of the Hittite Empire about 1800 B.C. There were certainly a great variety of languages and cultures functioning within a comparatively small area. Tablets from the Hittite archives at Bogaz Koy are written in at least 17 different languages, several of which cannot be related to any known linguistic stocks that we know of today. So obviously, in my opinion anyway, the Canaanites spoke a version of Hebrew, just as everybody else in the area did.
Well, yes, they probably most likely spoke a version of Hebrew. But, you know, Aram was always in that area around Damascus, and the Canaanites, in order to trade with Aram, which I'm sure they did, they would have had to speak Aramaic, which is absolutely very similar to Hebrew.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, again, now you're talking about the Canaanites worshiping a multiplicity of gods and being a Babylonian death cult, really.
Now, before the children of Israel came into the area, the Canaanites were writing in cuneiform.
Okay.
They weren't writing in Hebrew script.
Okay.
There's no writing in Hebrew script until the Hebrew conquest of Canaan.
Okay, all right.
There's no writing in Hebrew script found in Palestine until the conquest of Joshua.
Okay, right. Very good. And so, you know, so a lot of, even these scholars, the one I just quoted, he doesn't give the name of the scholar that he quoted here, but you know, they assume that the so-called Hittites and writing, you know, 17 different languages. What's his name? I can't think of his name. Waddell assumed that these Hittites are identical to Kati. Chatti is how he spells it. But in researching his work, he has, I believe he has them confused with the tribe of Gad.
Yes, he does. And in his book, the Phoenician Origin of the Breton, Scots, and Anglo-Saxons.
Yes.
L.A. Waddell takes an inscription found in Britain.
Right, in London, actually.
And it has the letters G.D. on it in reference to a man's tribe.
Okay.
And he takes the G.D. and tries to make it into Heth.
Yeah, right.
Yes. He tries to make it into, well, Heth is actually Keth. In Hebrew, it's the guttural CH, and it's a guttural TH.
Yes.
With a vowel in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's the word we get Hittites from. So Waddell, knowing that the tribe of Gad, I guess they must be Jews, so this couldn't have been Gad.
So they couldn't be Aryans, right.
Yeah, this has to be Hittites.
This has to be Hittites, because he assumes that the Hittites are Aryans and Jews are Hebrews. And it's actually the other way around.
It's absolutely the opposite.
Yeah, right. Or actually, let me correct myself. That the Jews are definitely not Hebrews. They're Kenites. Okay.
Yeah. Well, they're related to the Hittites.
Yeah.
Canaanites.
Kenites and Hittites are a related people. Hebrews and Aryans are a related people, and never the twain shall meet, folks.
On the Hittite inscriptions, these people are short in stature.
Yes.
They have thick lips. They have big floppy ears. They got sloping brows. And they look just like Jews.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't see how L.A. Waddell could. Now, there's Neo-Hittites, all right?
Okay.
To be distinguished from the ancient Hittites, there are Neo-Hittites.
Okay.
They're people called Neo-Hittites. I mean, they may have had Hittites mixed amongst them, but they were actually Aryan peoples who squeezed out the Hittites.
Okay.
And
right.
A lot of them were also the dispersed of Israel, the Saka,
right.
Sane, and the
yes.
Saka,
yes.
That never really crossed over the Caucasus Mountains, because they all didn't cross over the Caucasus Mountains.
Right.
A
yes.
lot of them stayed in Anatolia.
Yeah.
They were eventually known as Cappadocians, as white Syrians.
Yes.
They had several names, and they did mix with the Assyrians and the other peoples of the land
yeah.
that were there before that.
And east and south of the Euphrates, they became known as the Parthians.
Well, right. And the Parthians are actually identified soundly as a Saka or a Scythian
exactly.
tribe.
Exactly.
And they
people.
Have all Saka names.
Right.
And there's no doubt they weren't
right.
They weren't dispersed
yeah.
in Israel.
So Waddell, having in mind the false differentiation between Aryans and Hebrews that virtually all of Scholasticism today and, of course, the Jews teach, okay, that's false, and that's why he had no choice but to change the G into a K, okay, and which in his mind meant Hittite, when in fact it meant Gad. There's no doubt that it meant Gad. Okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and he's just wrong because he's following Jewish disinformation, okay? And the same thing goes for the Picts. The Picts were a non-Aryan people that lived in the northern part of England, you know, the British Isles there. And they made war with the Aryan Hebrews that invaded, namely the 12 tribes of Israel, that invaded England in the very earliest days, even starting in the 1500s BC, okay? And they conquered these Picts. Then later on, the Aryan invaders, the Hebrew Israelite invaders, became known as the kings of the Picts, not because they were Picts, but because they had taken dominion over them, okay? The Picts were like a 3 or 4 foot tall people that lived in barrows or berms, in little mounds that were just barely above the ground. The archaeology of these mounds is still there, and you can see that little people lived in those mounds, okay? And that's who the Picts were. They were a non-Aryan people conquered by the Aryan Hebrews. And, you know, they were pretty much wiped out, you know, but there had to be some amount of intermarriage between the two. And that's what the legends of the Pixies comes from, folks. The Pixies are actually Picts. They weren't little gremlins, but they kind of looked like little gremlins, you know. And very much, I really think that the people you described, the Hittites, okay, the Amorites, and the Picts are basically the same people.
That's you know, I really personally myself, I can't speak for prehistoric Scotland.
Okay.
And I won't. I haven't read anything about prehistoric. All I know is that the Picts of historic times, from the days of Tacitus, the Roman historian, had been identified with Germans on the mainland and had been described as being very redheaded.
Okay.
And that's yeah. all like, you know, it's only historic from the first century.
But these Picts were very, very, at full adulthood, they rarely reached 4 feet, okay, these Picts. And they have skeletal evidence, then they have dwelling evidence. Of course, this type of information is totally suppressed because they don't want you to know that there were little people.
Well, that sounds a lot like the people that the Greeks described in Anatolia as living in holes in the ground.
That's right, exactly.
That are basically considered by archaeologists to be the Amuru or the Amorites.
Or Amorites, exactly, exactly.
Who are amongst today's Jews? And,
right, of course they are. That's why Jews are, on average, at least 6 or 7 inches shorter than Aryan Hebrews, okay, and in many cases shorter than that, you know. That's because that's their heritage. They come from the Amorites and the Hittites, who are shorter, as you mentioned. They have hooked noses and receding foreheads, thick lips, etc., and big ears, just like the trolls, the trolls that you had to pay to get across the bridge. All right.
Well, that's why the trolls were depicted that way.
Yes.
That's why Rumpelstiltskin was depicted like he was.
Right, exactly.
Rumpelstiltskin was a Jew.
That's right.
There's no doubt.
Right, and typically, you go back into the ancient world, the local Jew, if they were had been given, let's say, a contract by the local king to be a tax collector or to be a toll collector, you know, they always arranged for that to be part of the government policy, okay? Because ordinarily speaking, you know, if you had an isolated troll or isolated Jew collecting a tariff to get across the bridge, you know, and you know, some Aryan group came along, they'd just kill him. You know, they wouldn't pay that guy any money.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, one of the earliest Germanic heroes is found in a story called the Nibelungenlied.
Right.
And his name was Siegfried. He was a prince from the Rhineland, actually from the northern parts of the Rhineland, up near the Netherlands, who was famous for having stolen the gold of a dwarf race called the Nibelungs.
Okay.
And now,
right, right.
Who does that describe?
That's right, exactly. You know.
What short people are running around with all the gold?
That's right, that's right. So, you know, these bridges and other, you know, tolls, not just bridges, but roads and what have you, passes between, you know, across mountain areas. You know, if they didn't have their own army, they had made a deal with the local king, who was more than likely an Aryan Hebrew, Saxon, what have you. And, you know, his army would support these people, and he'd take a cut of what of the tolls they collected, just as the IRS, okay, the Infernal Revenue Service is run by Jews, created by Jews, for Jews, and we're the ones paying the taxes, and it's the Aryan administrations empowering them. So it's the same story over and over again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. All right, so let's go back. I see. Go ahead.
With the picks, I have an unfinished thread from earlier. I really wanted to finish.
Okay.
And that was by describing the first settlements or the dominant settlers of Western Europe as being Phoenicians and Danans and other Hebrews. When the Cimmerians came across Europe, that they're said to have disappeared by mainstream historians and archaeologists today, and you could look this up in Encyclopedia Britannica and other encyclopedias,
mm-hmm.
They're said to have disappeared in the Hungarian plains around 500 BC.
Transylvania.
But shortly after that, like 100 years after that, these people called the Gauls suddenly appear and invade Rome.
Okay.
And that's also when the Cimbri crossed into Britain. And what I'm saying is that those Cimmerians became the Cimbri in Britain and the Gauls.
Right, right.
And
okay.
And that's when they appear in history, is when the Cimmerians disappear in archaeology.
Right, okay.
Now, when the later Saxons came, those Cimmerians are considered Celts by most ethnologists, and they met up with the people called Proto-Celts,
okay.
Who were actually the Phoenicians and the Danans, or the Proto-Celts.
Right, right.
They all spoke either P-Celtic or Q-Celtic
yes.
languages.
Right.
Now, the Saxons and the other, like the Goths and the other Germanic tribes, actually stayed in Asia for several hundred more years.
Right, right.
And had a much more serious Assyrian and Persian and Median impact on their language.
Right, exactly.
And that's why there's a big difference between the Celtic languages and the Germanic languages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all. I just wanted to finish that thread because
we've been
going where the wind blows us this evening.
Well, I know that you have, I think, on your website several links to, I think you have the Hebrew is English link. As part of your website. And
yes,
I have
a huge section that shows that English came from Hebrew.
Right, okay. And then on my website, I believe in the editorial section, I have an article by a Mormon scholar proving that German is at least one-third Hebrew, if not more.
Okay. You know, I actually saw that for the first time the other night.
Okay, yeah. And that is like total scholarship. You know, I mean, it's irrefutable scholarship. And it just totally disproves the reigning language tree philosophy, you know, evolutionary theory of language that prevails in academia today, okay? Because he shows without any possibility of being wrong that Hebrew and German are related languages, okay? So the academics simply have this wrong. They simply have it wrong. And the reason they have it wrong is because the Jews have been telling them what they're supposed to think.
Well, right, and I think that I don't know any German. I'll probably go read that page that you're referring to eventually,
mm-hmm.
As I get time. But my website, my section on English is from Hebrew, identifies maybe 600, 700 English words
right.
that definitely have Hebrew cognates.
Exactly.
And these are core English words.
Right. Right.
Words like bore and core and side and
yes.
and mirror. And,
yeah, and camel comes from the Hebrew gamel.
Well, right.
The G developed into a C.
Right, but when we see words like camel and gamel, we could imagine that, well, maybe when Englishmen met Arabs and they called them gamels because they speak a form of ancient Hebrew, Arabic is actually an offshoot of ancient Hebrew, that maybe that's a loan word.
Right.
And my website has a few loan words on it, but I tried to keep most of them in a separate section.
Right.
And hundreds and hundreds of words that I've identified
right.
can't possibly be loan words.
Right, right. Sure. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Well, that each language, you know, as I stated earlier, whatever area you move into, you have words that develop that are pertinent to your environment, okay, and the people that you're living with and around, okay?
So, well, right. Snow would not be a Hebrew word.
Right, exactly.
That's not happening.
No. But, you know, for example, Allah, my understanding is the word Allah, which is, of course, the Muslim God, is actually, you know, Baal, you know, they drop the B-A, and it's usually written B-A apostrophe A-L, and they simply drop the B-A, and it's Allah, Baal, it's Baal, it's still Baal.
Now, Allah is actually a Hebrew word for an oak tree.
Okay.
And I could probably come up with the Strong's number if I had my concordance with me.
Yeah, so you can see if the more you investigate Hebrew, the more you realize how many words in English, German, Dutch, et cetera, actually come from the Hebrew, folks. Why? Because we are Israel. And the Jews are still trying to promote their phony Hebrew, otherwise known as Yiddish. Okay?
Which Yiddish, is what it is. It's phony Hebrew.
That's right. That's what it is. It's phony Hebrew. Okay. Well, while you're looking that up, let me continue with Genesis chapter 11. I think I stopped at verse 4. And so continuing with verse 5, and Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men built. And, of course, at this stage of the game, we're talking about Adamites. We're talking about the descendants of Noah's three sons, right?
In verse 6,
and Yahweh said, behold, the people is one, okay, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So Yahweh scattered them abroad from there upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Now, allegorically, this is telling us that vain imaginations crept into their minds and they thought they could build a tower and reach heaven. Okay. And Yahweh said, no, this won't do. you people think you're more powerful or as powerful as I am. I'm not having any of this. I'm going to scatter you guys, you know, to all the directions of the earth. Isn't that what we're really talking about here?
I believe so. I believe this is an allegory for the, you know, man trying to promote himself and create a humanist society.
Right.
And,
exactly.
And Yahweh's squashing of that plan.
Yeah. Now, one of the popular renditions of this story is you have, you know, the Tower of Babel is being built, and you can see a spiral road,
which is a ziggurat.
Right. Going up and higher and higher and higher and higher. And then suddenly Yahweh commands everybody to speak different languages, and the guy carrying the bricks can't communicate to the guy laying them, and they get into a fight, and the one guy throws the other off the tower, and et cetera, okay, as if this happened instantaneously, okay? Now, maybe
right,
that happened.
Right, and the medieval mind, that was the subject of many medieval paintings.
Right.
And that was right. The way people thought in the Middle Ages, they took the Bible perfectly literally and
right.
understood it that way.
Yes, yeah. And so, yeah, we have to understand that a lot of the statements are allegorical, metaphorical, and not, you know, they have a literal meaning, you know, but we have to understand, for example, one of my favorite is when Lot was turned into a pillar of salt, or Lot's wife, rather, was turned into a pillar of salt.
Right. She wasn't really turned into a pillar of salt.
No, because that's a local idiom which people still use today. That means you were so scared that you literally froze in your tracks. That's what that idiom means.
Okay. And I'm sure there are some Kenite souvenir makers cashing in on that.
Right. So they're still looking for that statue of Lot's wife made out of literal salt, okay? So, you know, now maybe, you know, when obviously there's a lot of miraculous stuff that happens in Scripture, but we have to be careful not to make every statement miraculous when there's an idiom involved. We have to be careful.
Or when it's just a very simple, natural explanation.
Right, exactly. So she was petrified with fear is what that expression really means, folks. It doesn't mean that she was literally turned into salt. So, you have to, when there's a problem, always check the idioms, you know. So, I guess that covers the Tower of Babel story. Let me quote verse 9. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because Yahweh did there confound the language of all the earth, and from there did Yahweh scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Now, of course, if that was the major location, the center of the population of the descendants of Noah, you know, the Hamites, Shemites, and Japhethites, you know, we can see that all taking place over maybe a couple of hundred years.
Well, right. You know, the best chronology we have is the Septuagint, and the flood can be dated in the Septuagint. I'm not saying this is when it happened. I'm saying this is when it can be dated through the Septuagint.
Yes.
It's 3245 B.C.
Yes.
And you know, the rise of pharaonic civilization in Egypt is about 200 years after that,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't leave a whole lot of room.
Right, right, yeah. And,
however, we see the children of Israel go from 75 to 2 million
right.
in 200 years.
Exactly.
And I've done the math for that to figure out how that could be.
Right. There's a whole lot of begetting going on. Right.
Well, not really.
No?
I mean, I had 16 in 10 years.
75 to 2 million, that's pretty...
Not as much as you might think.
Really?
If every couple had 7 children
okay.
within 20 years... Then you go from 75 to 2 to
wow.
much more than to plenty to above 2 million in 200 years.
Right, right. Yeah, well, you know what? We Adamites better get busy because they're trying to kill us, and we got to replace the ones they're killing, you know.
Well, so. I've done my share, and I'm willing to try some more.
Right. Yeah, so we got to make more white people, folks. Otherwise, the Jews will win this. Of course, we know that Yahweh has guaranteed that his remnant will survive, and there's really nothing the Jews can do about it. They're trying really hard, though. They're trying their best to get rid of us. Let me just go into his other, again, we're talking about Jonathan Gray's book here. By the way, he has a website here. It's www.beforeus.com. Okay. So that's Jonathan Gray's website. And, this chapter he calls the imposter, and this is what we were talking earlier about the Nimrod and Semiramis myth. He puts it this way: the many pagan Christs were no more than a parody of the promised one. It began with Queen Semiramis of Babel, widow of the infamous Nimrod around 2000 BC. She had, like everyone else on earth at that time, a knowledge of the promised Messiah, passed down from her ancestors. Here is the background setting to the event. The world as a whole was familiar with the promise regarding the death of the deliverer who would do good deeds before his death. The prophecies already stated this God-man would be born of the seed of a woman, indicating a virgin birth, and that after his death he would rise from the dead and triumph against his enemies. So he goes on to say, you know, from his perspective here, that when Nimrod died, she, Semiramis, conceived like a virgin and brought forth a son, and that this Semiramis myth is actually what the Catholic Church worships, because the Catholic Church is actually Babylonian in origin, as we well know, And what they're teaching is really the Semiramis counterfeit myth, as opposed to the Virgin Mary Jesus Christ myth. So what do you make of this?
Well, you know, I would like to talk about Semiramis for a few minutes while we still have some time.
Okay, sure.
Because I was really prepared to do this.
Okay.
Okay. Herodotus dates Semiramis to five generations before the taking of Nineveh by the Medes.
Okay, which was when?
That was about 800 B.C.
800 B.C., okay.
And Semiramis, by Near Eastern scholars, is equated with a Shamu-Ramat,
okay,
the Babylonian wife of Shamshi Adad V, who
okay.
ruled from 811 B.C. to 808 B.C.
All right, okay.
And Herodotus does not, first he disconnects any role of the Babylonians in the conquest of Nineveh, and he talks about this queen Semiramis, who he actually gives her a minor role, but he says, this is what he says about her. Many sovereigns have ruled over the city of Babylon
mm-hmm.
and lent their aid to the building of its walls and the adornment of its temples.
Yes.
Of whom I shall make mention in my Assyrian history, which we don't have.
Mm, right.
Among them, two were women. Of these, the earlier, called Semiramis, held the throne five generations before the later princess.
Mm-hmm.
She raised certain embankments well worthy of inspection in the plain near Babylon to control the river,
mm-hmm.
which until then used to overflow and flood the whole country round about.
Mm-hmm.
The later of the two queens, whose name was Nitocris, a wiser princess than her predecessor, not only left behind her as memorials of her occupancy of the throne, the works which I shall presently describe, but also observing the great power and restless enterprise of the Medes, who had taken so large a number of cities, and among them Nineveh. And I'll end it there. So we see that Herodotus is saying that Semiramis lived five generations before Nitocris, who was contemporary with the taking of Nineveh by the Medes, which happened in 608 B.C.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can't even put Semiramis back to 800
well,
B.C.
Well, as is very common, people, historians, archaeologists, sometimes get the timing wrong and project a personality into the ancient past when they shouldn't. Do you think that's what's going on here?
Well, we have the testimony of Herodotus, which puts Semiramis not far before, earlier than between 700 and 800 B.C.
Yeah, okay.
And then we have Diodorus of Sicily.
Okay.
Now, Diodorus of Sicily is the most excellent librarian and historiographer.
Okay.
Who compiled a history of what he considered the world, which is the white world, as far back as he could from all the best sources he could find.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't fault him at all, except that sometimes his sources weren't the best, the most accurate. And he dates Semiramis to 21 generations before the fall of Troy.
Okay.
Which would be like 1700 B.C.
Okay, well, that's kind of where the ballpark that Jonathan Gray describes here. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But now, this is from Diodorus, and this is he gives this entire thing about Semiramis and how she was a goddess, and
right.
he connects her. He says she was raised by doves and nurtured by fish, and he connects her with the fish goddess Derketo as her mother.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
Derketo is the Assyrian fish goddess. She's the mother of Semiramis. She abandons Semiramis. Semiramis is fed by doves. Now, this is important.
Okay.
And a lot of people, I don't know if anybody's ever made this connection.
Okay.
All right? I'd never read it. But it hit me in the head as soon as I read Diodorus.
You're piquing my interest.
Okay, well, let's go on.
Yes.
Now, all of the tales, the fantastic tales about Semiramis are found in Diodorus of Sicily.
Okay.
All right, but none of them are found in Herodotus.
You're right, okay.
Now, Herodotus is writing in 450 B.C. Diodorus is writing 400 years later in 50 B.C.
Okay.
It's apparent to me that all these tales are invented.
Yes.
By either the Greeks or the Mesopotamians,
okay.
It don't matter, in between the time
right.
of Herodotus
so, in
and
other
Diodorus.
Words, In other words, the account has become mythologized by that time.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to say this. Tammuz, in the ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions, Tammuz is a minor, obscure god.
Mm-hmm.
He's a consort of Ishtar.
Okay.
In a couple of places, he's called the object of Ishtar's childhood love or early love.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
And he's only mentioned a couple of times, and then he's mentioned every mention of Tammuz after a certain period is only because it's a month of the year named
mm-hmm.
for him.
Yeah.
But he's a very obscure minor god in the Assyrian pantheon.
Okay.
Semiramis is not mentioned
right.
in any of the ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions.
Okay.
None of them. Not one.
Okay.
Now, Ninus is not mentioned in any, and Ninus is the legendary founder of Nineveh.
Yes, and that's M-E-N-E-S for people who are not familiar with the
But this Nineveh. Is a very late tale.
Mm-hmm.
He's not mentioned in any early inscriptions.
Okay.
I mean, there is an entire Assyrian pantheon of gods.
Sure.
But they're not Ninus and Semiramis and Nimrod.
Okay, well, just like we were talking about Hinduism, claiming an antiquity which it doesn't really have, it sounds like, you know, these later myths, incorporated more recent people and entities and so-called gods and goddesses and projected them further into the past.
Right. Okay. But the one thing that's interesting in the Semiramis story,
okay,
even though I can't find the story in antiquity,
okay,
Semiramis comes from a fish,
right.
from a fish goddess.
Yes.
And she's nurtured and fed by doves.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, the fish god, that represents genetic manipulation.
Here's the interesting thing about it.
Okay.
Jonah went to Assyria.
Okay.
To Nineveh.
Right.
And the Assyrians listened to him, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Well, he came out of a fish, and his name means dove.
Okay. Okay, very interesting. So, in other words, it's the Jonah story mythologized.
It very well may be.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting.
Jonah means dove in Hebrew.
Okay, okay.
And probably in Assyrian, too, because they spoke a Semitic language.
Okay. Yeah, now, what about, do you think that's the source of the word John, or the name John and Jonathan?
It's a very similar name, yes.
Okay.
I haven't done the linguistic study on it, though.
Right, right. Okay.
For Johannes,
yes,
which is
yes.
John.
All right. At the very least, what our discussion today implies is that a lot of these myths, these mythological stories, do have a historical basis. Okay. There's no doubt about that. But they have, essentially, I would say, you're talking a lot about Hebrew myths, or Hebrew stories, rather. True Hebrew stories that have been retold so many times that, for example, Samson becomes Hercules, okay? Noah becomes, what's the name in the Sumerian account? You mentioned it several times.
Well, there's Deucalion, who is the Greek.
Okay.
The Greek of the flood.
Okay.
And there is a Sumerian flood account, and the name is just lost on me right now.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, but
right.
I don't have it in my head.
Right, right. But so in other words, so you take the Hebrew name, translate it into another language, retell the story in another language, and another language, and another language, and another language. And that's
it's basically, it's the telephone game
right.
100 times.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? Because, I mean, the Greeks were Danans, they were Israelites, they were Dorian, they were Israelites. The Assyrians, they descended from Semites. The Persians descended from Shemites. They all had the same tales, but in their isolation and in their separate culture and their separate tongue.
Gilgamesh, thank you.
Right, Gilgamesh. Well, Gilgamesh was a giant.
Okay.
He wasn't from the flood.
Oh, okay.
But he was one of the giants.
All right.
And there is a flood figure in Akkadian literature. And I'm sorry, I ain't got it right now. It's not in my head right now.
Okay, yeah.
Something like that happens.
But I think we're making the point here that this constant retelling has resulted in the confusion of all these stories, all of which have probably a historical antecedent, and the antecedent has simply been lost. You know, it's become obscured. But a lot of this stuff actually comes from actual Hebrew stories.
Utna, I got it. I can't come up with it. It's U-T-N-A
something. Utna Pishtu or something. Utna
Pishtu. Yeah, something like that.
Something like that, right.
If you look at Gilgamesh, all right, Gilgamesh in that epic makes a long journey.
Okay.
And with Enkidu, and they have adventures on this journey.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Odysseus and Heracles and Jason and the Argonauts, all of these are tales of heroes taking long journeys.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all very, very similar in their structure, all
right.
of these tales.
Yeah, we have the Odyssey, Ulysses.
Utnapishtim.
Utnapishtim, something like
Akkadian
that.
Akkadian flood figure.
Okay,
it's
right.
Utnapishtim.
Right.
And that's why I couldn't remember it.
Yeah, it's an odd name. It's like Gladys. You never hear it anymore.
Utnapishtim? No, right. I'm not going to name any of my boys that, no matter how many I have.
Right, exactly. Okay. Yeah, so I think we have, and all of this, this is so important in reference to linguistics, that these stories have been mythologized, and now all these names have a historical antecedents. There's simply no doubt about this, you know. And, once we understand that the mythology has Hebrew sources, and that the Hebrew, now wouldn't it be correct to say, you know, given Enoch, Moses, the patriarchs before Noah, didn't these people know how to write? Weren't these people actually writing?
Well, yes and no. You know, there's really no writing in Greece that we know of
mm-hmm.
until about 800 BC.
Okay.
And maybe that's a little early.
But isn't the book of Enoch earlier than all that?
Well, the
and the Bible itself earlier than all that?
Yes, by 700 years.
Okay.
But I mean, Hebrews were writing by 1500 BC, according
right.
to the Bible.
Okay, and that takes us back
believable.
To Egypt and the the hieroglyphs of Egypt. Okay.
But writing was very, very difficult before the Hebrew alphabet.
Right.
The first gift that the Hebrews gave to the world was a phonetic alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
Assyrian cuneiform and Babylonian cuneiform. If you ever seen that stuff, I would never even try.
Yeah.
To
well,
figure
it's
any of that. I mean, it's very, very arcane, and
right.
every the pictograms, and it's very difficult.
Right, right. And each picture has a set meaning, and I think Chinese is like that even today, where they don't have they don't have letters that make words necessarily. I read about it, and that's why they can't make a Chinese typewriter.
Right, and that debunks the whole thing about the Chinese having invented movable type. Because they got like 10,000 characters.
Who said that?
that's one of these New Age stories the Jews made up in order to debunk.
You got to be kidding me. I hadn't heard that one.
Oh, yeah, it's out there.
Yeah, and so, yeah, the Chinese written language is still pictograms, and therefore there's no way to convert it to – you can't put it on a typewriter.
Right. It would be a mile wide, the
That's
carriage.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, so, letters forming words is a Hebrew idea, okay? That is Aryan, folks. It's a Hebrew Aryan idea, and there would be no typewriters unless language were condensed into letters and phonemes and syllables, etc. Okay, that's the genius of the Hebrew language and the Hebrew letters. Now,
right. Well, what I'm trying to say is that writing became a lot more prevalent once that alphabet spread.
Right. Right. Okay. Now, one more question. I see we're at the end of the 90 minutes because I really want people to understand how the Hebrew script is in fact the same as the Phoenician script. And that, it's the Hebrews who brought, like the Agam script, what's called Gaelic, Phoenician, etc. That's really all Hebrew. And in my understanding, even the Nordic script, the Nordic runes, are a version of the original Hebrew. And isn't that proof that the Hebrew and Aryan are not different in any way?
Right, they're not different in any way. And Agam and other scripts like that are definitely alphabets, developed during the dispersion.
Yeah, they're versions.
I'm not positive about Agam, though, but I've read, I don't know how true it is, that was actually to conceal what was being said from the Roman conquerors.
Interesting.
I'm not 100% sure of that.
Yeah,
but that's what I've read.
Yeah, because the so-called Phoenicians also created this myth that if you sail too far out into the Atlantic, you'll fall off the edge.
Well, they did that in order to prevent the Greeks from wandering into the Atlantic.
Exactly.
And they did everything they could. They had a trade game going on,
right,
with the tin in Cornwall. And
a monopoly.
Natural,
yeah.
Right. There's actually a tale in Strabo about a Phoenician sea captain. The Romans were trying to follow these Phoenician ships,
right,
to see where they were getting their tin from.
Okay, sure.
And there were, Strabo relates a story about a certain Phoenician sea captain purposely wrecking his ship on the rocks,
uh-huh,
so that the Romans couldn't find a way to Cornwall.
Right, right, yeah. Because they wanted to maintain that monopoly. And,
right,
you know, and if they found it, if the Greeks and Romans later had, when for obviously the Caesars discovered this, and that's why the Caesars went to war against Britain, don't you know? Okay. That's why Julius Caesar invaded Britain. So, because rather than having to buy tin from the British, well, let's take it.
Absolutely.
We're wasting our money buying it. Let's just take it. And that's why Julius Caesar invaded Britain. Okay? So it's obvious that the Phoenicians, one of their ploys was to make up this mythology about falling off the edge of the world. You know? And, of course, you know, superstitious sailors are going to, you know, think twice about falling off the edge of the world. And they're not going to follow their captain when he says, let's sail on, boys. You know, that's a lie, you know. And so that was a very clever lie that they invented to keep them from, horning in on their business. That's all it was. And then that lie became science, the science of the Middle Ages, I guess, you know. And so that's history, folks. All right. All right. So any other thoughts about, you know, the Hebrew and Phoenician becoming, actually being identical, and, you know, the Hebrew, Welsh, Gaelic, and all that? You know, are people really need to understand that the languages we speak today are from Hebrew?
Right. And the original Celtic languages of Western Europe were all Hebrew peoples that had settled in Western Europe. I mean, that's why they called it Iberia.
Right.
Because it was Hebrew land.
Right.
And one of the first nations described by the Greeks, the other side of the Caucasus Mountains where the Scythians traveled, was also called Iberia.
Right. There was Iberia near the Caucasus, and then the Spanish Peninsula was called Iberia.
And it should be absolutely clear. That proves right there that both of those people had to be Hebrews.
Right. And then parts of England are referred to as Hibernia.
Right.
Another version of Iberia. Okay.
Actually, Ireland, the original name of it was Hibernia on all the to the Roman writers.
Oh, okay. You mean Britain itself?
Well, they actually considered Ireland
Hebrides, yes,
and Britain to be the same people.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so Hebrews, folks.
In fact, Strabo calls them the Britons of Hibernia, meaning the Irish.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then the original settlers, as far as I understand it, of Ireland were referred to as the Tuatha De Danann, okay? Which
right.
Means,
and they were followed by the Milesians, who were Phoenicians from Miletus.
Right. So the Tuatha De Danann means the tribe of Dan.
Yes.
That's what it means, folks. So the tribe of Dan, since they abode in ships, they were the best sailors of all the other tribes. They, you know, they sailed up the Danube River, named the Danube River after themselves, and the Don River after themselves, the Dnieper River after themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And even Ireland originally was named by them, okay? So you can trace the history of these European nations totally in the migrations of the 12 tribes of Israel. There's simply no doubt about this, folks. Absolutely no doubt about this. And, of course, the academic world and the Jews are fighting this truth tooth and nail. But we know the reality, and that's why none of these people will ever debate us, because we'll blow them right out of the water. All right, Bill. It's been fun tonight. It's too bad Jonathan Gray couldn't make it. I'll see if I can get him on the show at another time.
Yeah, I really would have liked to talk about some of those myths at greater length and to hear his spin on them. And
right. Well, obviously, you know, he has been influenced by these myths, as you mentioned, the difference between Herodotus and who was the other guy?
Theodore Siculus. Theodorus Siculus. Theodorus of Sicily.
Okay. Oh, Siculus stands for Sicily. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Very good. Okay. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for listening this evening. We're going to tomorrow. We're going to be continuing with the book of Romans. It'll be Romans Part 5. And, of course, the call numbers for that show are different. Yahweh's Covenant People, it's 21924. Let everybody you know about these shows, because we are doing scriptural and historical analysis that no one else on the planet is doing, folks. Nobody's doing anything like this, certainly not your Judeo-Christian. The Jews want this covered up because they don't want you, the Caucasian people, to know that you are Israel. They don't want you to know that. They want you to think you're a Gentile. They want you to think you're a stupid Goyim. All right, that's how they want you to think. And, of course, the vast majority of people actually believe that rubbish. Now, on Sunday, my guest is going to be Mike Delaney, who is the founder of the website JesusIsNotAJew.com. You can go click on that website, www.JesusIsNotAJew.com. He's got a really good opening video that shows Oprah Winfrey interviewing a Jewish girl, admitting that her family sacrificed Christian children in satanic rituals. And then in the video, or actually an audio just below that, he's got me and Bill talking about why Jesus is not a Jew. Okay? So he, yes, ProThink is maybe another website he has. But he's going to be my guest on Sunday. And, of course, the call numbers for that, and that's the Voice of Christian Israel, 22187. That'll be noon Eastern time, 11 Central time. Thanks for joining us, everybody. It's going to be a fun weekend. Thank you very much, Bill.
No problem. Thank you.
And Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.
Good night.
Good night.